Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. And by the team at Gelser Investment Management, focused on individuals and families, helping to build, manage, preserve, and transfer wealth for generations, commemorating 45 years in business. Gelser.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today, we present Arthur C. Brooks, president of American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research.
In case you're not familiar with the American Enterprise Institute, it is a highly respected private, nonpartisan, not-for-profit institution dedicated to research and education on issues of government, politics, economics, and social welfare. Founded in 1938, AEI is populated by scholars and supporters committed to expanding liberty, increasing individual opportunity, and strengthening free enterprise through independent thinking, open debate, reasoned argument, facts, and the highest standards of research. Today's speaker, Dr. Arthur C. Brooks, is the president of the American Enterprise Institute. He's a man widely known for his writings and speaking on the relationship of economics, culture, and politics. Dr. Brooks came to the Institute early in 2009, following 8 years as a professor of business and government policy at Syracuse University, and 3 years as a business professor at Georgia State University. But Dr. Brooks brings to us a career history unequaled by any other speaker who has graced our podium in this club's 40-year history. Prior to his career in public policy, he spent 12 years as a professional French hornist with the City Orchestra of Barcelona and other ensembles. We have with us a true Renaissance man. More recently, however, our speaker has authored 10 books and hundreds of articles on wide-ranging topics. His most recent book is a New York Times bestseller entitled The Road to Freedom: How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. He describes himself as an independent whose views have been influenced mostly by Milton Friedman, Charles Murray, James Q. Wilson, and Irving Kristol, all four previous Economic Club of Indiana speakers. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome our special guest, Dr. Arthur Brooks.
Thank you, Deborah. Thanks to all of you. What an honor to be here before you. I always look forward to coming to Indianapolis. I always look forward to getting out of Washington, to be truthful with you. It's a pretty tough environment, as you know. It's bitter and partisan, and people are fighting all the time. I'm not from Washington, D.C., and I always found that environment pretty disconcerting. Deborah just told you that I moved to Washington in the beginning of 2009. I'm actually from the real Washington. I'm from Seattle, Washington, which is pretty far away from the battles of Washington, D.C. When I first got to Washington and to run the American Enterprise Institute, I had a colleague who had been in D.C. for 40 years. He said, "Welcome to Washington." I said, "Thanks." He said, "It's a tough place." And I said, "I'm aware." He said, "Well, you better know who your friends are." And I said, "That's good advice, but how do I know who my friends are?" And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, "They're the ones who stab you in the chest." So all was good to get out. All was good to get out. On behalf of all my colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you for what you're doing for my country. Thank you for what you're doing for the economy, and thank you for your interest in what we're talking about here today. What I'm going to tell you here today is that we have in our hands the greatest system ever devised to help the poor. I'm going to try to do two things. I'm going to tell you how I think we can open people's hearts to the blessings of the free enterprise system. And I'm going to tell you how I think we can design a system that helps more people succeed and more people build their lives who are currently marginalized and vulnerable. Now, to start doing that, I want to talk about something that's a little bit different. I want to talk to you about how long it takes for someone to make a judgment about you. As an economist, I've studied a lot of economic psychology and behavior, and one of the things that I've run across, which is really interesting, is a lot of research that talks about how long it takes for someone to sum you up, to figure out what you're made of. Now, you always hear when you go into a job interview that your eye contact and the firmness of your handshake really matters. Does it? How long does it take for someone to figure out what you're all about? We know the answer. The answer is 7 seconds. 7 seconds is all you've got, because that's how long it takes for people to figure out what you're made of. There's a wonderful body of research that's currently coming out of New York University. It's published in the journal Nature Neuroscience. You've probably let your subscription lapse. But what the researchers are looking at is a very interesting part of the human brain. That's called the posterior cingulate cortex. It's about the size of a walnut, and it's in the center of your brain. It's very ancient. It evolved a long time ago, perhaps a million years ago. And it evolved in the human brain for our survival. And that's the part of the brain that not consciously, that unconsciously sums up other people. Are they friends or are they foes? Now, that was an important thing. All of you have that really well developed, because if you didn't, you, your ancestors would not have passed on their genetic material and you wouldn't be sitting here today. 100,000 years ago, you weren't worrying about the firmness of a job candidate's handshake. You were worrying whether or not someone was going to beat you over the head and take your stuff. That's the reason that this part of the onboard hardware of the human brain was developed. Well, today, of course, we use it in social situations. Think about the last time that you judged somebody accurately in just a few seconds. Can you think of a time in your life when you did that? A job candidate, for good or for ill, a politician? Maybe somebody you saw at the podium giving a speech? Good, bad? You made an immediate and subjective judgment, but that was your posterior cingulate cortex at work. Let me tell you, when I was preparing my remarks today, I was thinking, what was my example of that? And let me tell you what it was. Because a very profound turning point in my life came from a snap judgment. When I was in my early 20s, Deborah told you that I made my living as a French horn player. See, when I was 19 years old, I dropped out of college, dropped out, kicked out, splitting hairs. And I went on the road as a musician. It was my dream. And I traveled all over the place. And at one point, I was on a chamber music tour playing the French horn in the Burgundy region of France. Beautiful. And the first night that I was there, I was very jet-lagged. I had gotten off the plane, and they threw me right on stage. And I was playing, and I looked out into the audience. And this is... when I'm 24 years old, I looked out into the audience just like this, and in the front row, I saw a girl. And I said, wow, she's really pretty. And she was smiling at me, which was weird. And I said, I made a mental note. Being a good red-blooded American boy, I said, I'm going to talk to that girl after the concert. And I did. I went up to her and said, hi, and how are you, and what's your name? And it turned out she spoke not one word of English. Not one word of English. So there was a lot of gesticulation and sort of international sounding phrases. Turns out she wasn't French. She was Spanish. I learned that much. And here's the weirdest part. You know, the first thing that came into my head in the first 7 seconds I was talking to this girl who didn't understand a word I was saying, jumped into my head. This is the first time I'd ever thought this before. I said, I'm going to marry that girl. Now, believe me, that thought had never crossed my mind at 24. Long story short, we're celebrating our 23rd wedding anniversary and we have 3 kids. Okay, maybe coincidence, right? Researchers say no way, no way. We do this all day, every day. These are the stakes in your success, is the first 7 seconds. So the question is, how are you using your 7 seconds? Using them well? Using them poorly? How do you use your 7 seconds? Now, I thought about this an awful lot when I first came to the American Enterprise Institute. It's a think tank. What does a think tank do? Most people don't know. What does our mission statement say? Is our 7 seconds any good? One of the things that I noticed when you run a think tank, you know the first 7 seconds of any speech from a think tank person? Here's the first 7 seconds. Is this thing on? 7 seconds are gone, right? What was our mission statement? The mission statement of my institution was AEI, is a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., dedicated to high-quality, nonpartisan policy analysis. You're not still awake. I know. That had to change. And the truth of the matter is your 7 seconds, the 7 seconds of really effective people, causes, organizations, and companies, they do one thing really well, which is to state their purpose, their aspirational purpose, why they're really put on this earth. Let me give you the best 7 second introduction I have ever heard. And this is a trivia contest for you because I want to see if any of you know what these 7 seconds, the first 7 seconds. Let's see if you recognize these 7 seconds. I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. What does that 7 seconds come from? Those are the first 7 seconds of the I Have a Dream speech of Martin Luther King Jr. The most effective, powerful speech given in recent decades. And it was set in the first 7 seconds. So how do we state our purpose? All compelling organizations do. They use their introduction in exactly that way. The companies that work best, and they can be wildly divergent in what they do, they have their 7 seconds of purpose really down. What do you know about Apple Computer? Well, you can say what they produce, but that's not what people learn first. They think they know that Apple Computer thinks different and encourages you to do the same. Amway, one of my favorite companies because it's so interesting. Nobody knows from year to year what they're going to be selling and what they're going to be doing. It's a direct marketing organization where people sell consumer products to each other. What a crazy business model. What do you know about Amway? If you go to their headquarters, you know one thing, which is written on the side of their building. Freedom, family, hope, and reward. And they really mean it. Everything they do comes down to those principles and that statement of purpose. So when I came to AEI and I was thinking about this an awful lot, I said, okay, I'm going to rewrite the mission statement because I want our 7 seconds to really matter a lot. And here it is. I say it in every speech. The American Enterprise Institute is a community of scholars and supporters dedicated to the proposition that maximizing liberty, increasing individual opportunity, and fighting for free enterprise gives the most people the best life. Nothing about money. Nothing about business, nothing even about economics, and I'm an economist. It's all about more people building a better life for their human dignity. So where are we so far? So I'm about to start talking about policy. Principle number one, you've got 7 seconds. This is brain science, not conjecture. Principle number two, you better use your 7 seconds to state your purpose, or people won't know what you're all about, and you won't be able to live your purpose. So where are we today in the free enterprise movement? The movement that brought me to the American Enterprise Institute, the movement that brought a lot of you out for lunch today, was the idea that free enterprise is good and right and just, and it's the best system for America, and it's the best system for people around the world. Where are we in that movement today? If you ask a lot of people, what does free enterprise stand for? What is it in politics that we should stand for as free enterprise advocates? People say things like this. We stand for limited government, less regulation, less debt, lower deficits, and lower government spending. Now, that's good stuff, in my view. I like that product line. That's kind of what I got a PhD in, was that product line. But that's not purpose. That's not the purpose that brings us all here together. And as a matter of fact, if you talk about those products, people will hear your implied purpose is this. Those free enterprise advocates, they fight against things. Their purpose is fighting against things. Fighting against deficits and debt and regulation and government spending and out-of-control bureaucracy and all that stuff. And they might agree with you or they might not, but they know that your purpose is actually fighting against things. That's a problem in an environment in this country that's characterized by vulnerability, by uncertainty, and by increasing poverty. And it actually tells us the reason why people say the following. When asked in October of 2013 by the Associated Press, do you believe the word compassionate describes the Republican Party? 16% of citizens said yes. A UCLA study finds that conservative citizens are more than 50% likely to say that conservative leaders are somewhat heartless. If you look at the data on the 2012 presidential election, no matter how you voted on it, you know that there's only one statistic that you need to know. And that statistic was, who cares more about people like you? The loser in that election lost that question 2-1. We're not getting our point across in the free enterprise movement, no matter how you vote. So what's the solution? The solution is not fighting against things. The solution is fighting for people. The solution is to say, we fight for Americans and their families so they can build better lives, no matter how they vote, and really believe it and really mean it. That's what our leaders need to do, and I believe that's what we need to do as well. We say that, people will listen. We say that, and people will know this is about winning the future, not about winning elections. I mean to fight for people and help them no matter how they vote. But that also brings up a new problem. How do we actually do that as advocates for the free enterprise system, as people who are willing to come out for lunch with at the Economic Club? How are we, as people involved every day in the functioning of the free enterprise system, going to fight for people who are vulnerable? Let's think about a few facts. Is there need in this country? Yeah. As an economist, here's the big lie that people in my profession always tell you. America is in a slow but steady recovery. Yeah, that's a lie. How's that a lie? Because we actually have two recoveries. The top half of the income distribution in America is at about a 4.5% economic growth rate. The bottom half is at zero. The bottom half is not recovering. If you're in the bottom half of the income distribution, you've seen less take-home pay for your family in real terms every year for 6 years. Nothing like that has happened in the bottom of the income distribution since the Great Depression. Don't let anybody tell you that the country is coming back for people in the bottom half in the United States, because it's not true. The bottom half is still in recession. We always say, can you believe it? People think we're still in recession. I got the data. It's not true. We've been out of recession for a long time. Yeah, we are. We're still in recession. The stock market, I don't know what it's doing today. Last I looked, the Dow was down by 50 points. Who cares? It's been a huge rally. Bulls all over the place. Since President Obama took office in January of 2009, the stock market's up 108%. Who got that? 81% of those gains went to Americans in the top 10% of the income distribution. We could not have set up a better economic system to benefit the rich than what we've done in the past 5 years. And you heard that from the president of the American Enterprise Institute. Meanwhile, what's going on at the bottom? Food stamp recipiency is up by 50%. We've gone from 32 million Americans on food stamps to 48 million Americans on food stamps. A 50% increase in the past 5 years. One in six Americans is so poor as to require food assistance in the richest country in the history of the world. That's a scandal, and it means our country is not coming back and is not serving people at the bottom, and it's not right. Disability insurance, which as we all know, is basically secret code for permanent unemployment insurance for Americans, is up by 20%. Every year in the past year, 1 million Americans have newly enrolled in the permanent unemployment system of disability insurance in the United States. That is a have and have not economy. You hear that unemployment rate is going down? It's just a myth. The reason the unemployment rate is going down is because people are dropping out of the workforce. Only 62.8% of adults of working age and ability are in the workforce. That's the lowest it's been since the days of Jimmy Carter. And it continues to go down. This is nothing to celebrate. What is the unemployment rate among African-American teenagers in America today? 36%. 36%. This is effectively two countries. So our system is neglecting the poor. Our system is helping the rich and not lifting up people who are at the bottom of the income distribution. So here's the question. If we're going to do something about that, if we're going to be warriors for that, if we're going to fight for people, we got to ask this. What do they need? What do people in the bottom need so that we know what we can do? It's shocking how little we have an answer to that in our public policy process. Everybody kind of thinks they know what poor people need. Nobody really studies it. I have a very close friend who did his PhD in political science studying poverty. And he was working at the Poverty Research Center at a Big Ten university. Poverty Research Center. Now, one day he was working on his dissertation, surrounded by other researchers in poverty. And who should come through the door of the research center but an actual poor person? Okay? Asking for help. Saw the sign, said the Poverty Research Center. He says, maybe I can get some relief, right? He walks in and they didn't know what to do. One guy wanted to call security. What do we do? It's a poor person. You know, I've never seen one of those before, right? That's a problem. What do poor people need? You know, I can look at data all day long and give a bunch of stats, but let me tell you what we've been doing at AEI on this subject. We've been collecting data by going into poor communities and asking people who've rebuilt their lives, what do poor people need? What did you need? What do you need to earn your success, to be a successful person, to lift yourself up, to understand the true meaning of enterprise, which is not building a business, it's building your life. What do you need? And here's what they say. It's pretty interesting. It's different than what shows up in the academic journals. They say three things. Now, these are from interviews from parts of Washington, D.C. and other cities where researchers and politicians don't go. We're talking to people who've just gotten out of prison. We're talking to people who've been homeless. We're talking to former drug addicts. We're talking to former prostitutes. We're talking to people who've been on the fringes and margins of society. You say, what do you need? And they say, three things. Three things. First, there's a need for personal change. There's a need for redemption. Second, there's a need to deal with basic poverty. There's relief that we need. And third, there's a need to have a future that's full of hope. In other words, and this is uniform across these groups, we need three things. Poor people need three things in this order: transformation, relief, and opportunity. That's what we need to provide. If we don't take care of all of those things, we're not helping poor people and we're not bringing our country back. If you want to fight for people who are marginalized, you have to fight for those three things. Transformation, relief, and opportunity are the basis of a true social justice agenda. And I want to tell you what we're finding and what I think we need to do, and I want to submit that to you for your consideration. Let's start off with transformation. Nobody in Washington, D.C. wants to talk about transformation. Transformation is a really crummy topic because you have to start talking about things that people don't want to talk about, like morals and personal behavior and culture. People hate talking about that stuff because it's so uncomfortable. But the data are the data and the experiences are the experiences. Let me tell you what I've found in years of looking at personal transformation and what all of the literature tells us. There's a secret to well-ordered lives full of meaning. There's a secret. As a matter of fact, there's a formula. There are four things that characterize people who transform their lives, four things that are correlated most with successful, happy, well-ordered lives. The four things are faith, family, community, and work. Not because of money work, because of the culture of work. Those are the things that actually transform people's lives. So why don't we fight for those things? Why don't we talk about those things as a matter of lifting people out of poverty? Not Puritanism or moralism, as a matter of lifting people out of poverty, of being a good Samaritan, of treating the least of these, our brothers and sisters, with particular care and respect. Why don't we talk about those things? It's because they're uncomfortable for us to talk about those things, but think about it. If there's a poor child in this country, and there is, this very night, 22,000 children will sleep on the street in New York City alone. If there are poor children in this country, aren't they our children? And wouldn't you share these ideas with your children? If there are poor men and women who suffer from substance abuse or mental illness and they are indigent, aren't they our brothers and sisters? And if there are brothers and sisters, won't we share the secret to truth and beauty and happiness with them? That's the question we need to answer ourselves when it comes to public policy and personal transformation. Relief. Relief. You know, when I talk to groups of political conservatives, which I do a lot, and I talk about relief, people grab their checkbooks. This is what conservatives are really, really good at. I published a book in 2006. It was called Who Really Cares? And one of the things I found in it is that political conservatives give more to charity than political liberals do, even correcting for their income. And it was a big insight to me. I didn't know that. I come from a liberal democratic family. What I'm doing today is shocking to them. talking about the free enterprise system, but the facts are the facts. Conservatives give a lot. That's great, and I admire that. And charity is unreplaceable. You know, we give $300 billion a year to charity, which is more than the entire GDP of Chile or Denmark or Israel, lots and lots and lots of developed countries. And it's a wonderful miracle, and no other country comes even close per capita. The problem is this. It's not enough. If we look at what it took to rebuild the Gulf region in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, private charity, which was so abundant, which was magnificent and wonderful, came to less than 10% of what was needed to rebuild that region. Charity alone can't do it. We need more than that. And that's the reason when I talk to conservative political groups, one of the things that I say is that it's time to declare peace on the safety net for the indigent. The government safety net has no replacement. It is one of the greatest achievements of our society to provide that. Now, from a free market advocate, it sometimes sounds strange, but when there is so much need, it's a good thing for us to be able to do that. And that does not mean wanton public spending. No, quite the contrary. If you're a warrior for the poor and you believe in the safety net for the most indigent members of society, you better be a hawk on wasting money on things like out-of-control entitlement spending. You know, the most boring topic in my business is entitlement spending. Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, you start sounding like you're just going through accounting facts and figures, and people don't want to hear about it. That's the reason that these subjects frequently don't get any traction in public policy debates, because they're so boring. Here's why it's not boring. When I look across the Atlantic at the marginalized countries of Greece and Spain and Portugal and Ireland and increasingly Italy, what do they have in common? What they have in common is that out-of-control entitlement spending made them insolvent. The insolvency led to austerity, and the austerity marginalized the poor and took away the safety net. If you believe, like I do, in a safety net with integrity and that's trustworthy and that's impenetrable and that we can count on and we have moral promises to the poor, you better join me in being militant about getting entitlements under control, because as sure as I'm standing here today, we will hurt the poor the most if we don't solve these problems in this country. Entitlement reform is about protecting poor people. It's a natural chain and it is inevitable and it's true. We don't need to spend more money. We have plenty of money. We have to keep our promises about helping poor people, and that means doing hard things. So that's relief. But now we get to the great one. Now we get to opportunity, because this is where you shine. This is where the free enterprise community is so great, because this is what we're talking about all day long. We're the opportunity contingent in our society. This is where we live, is in providing opportunities. This is what you do all day long. And how do we do it? We work for opportunity for everybody, especially poor people, by standing for four things: education reform, the dignity of work, entrepreneurship all through the economy, especially among the poor, and the morality of the free enterprise system. And these are going to be the end of my remarks as I talk about each one of these things. First is education. You know, I know it's a hot topic and there's so much controversy and people beat each other up about teachers, unions, and bureaucracies, et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't look at the facts, you're missing out on the true story of how we deny civil rights to poor people in this country. 25% of the kids in this country are not getting an adequate education because we have a public school system that serves grown-ups, not kids. That's a scandal. That's just not right. I mean, I live in Bethesda, Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. The nation's capital, the Washington, D.C. school system, spends per kid each year $18,475. Wow, it's great. They must be getting a great education, right? 56% of them graduate from high school. The percentage of eighth graders that reads at grade level, 15%. That's what we're getting for $18,475. If you think more money is going to improve that, then you believe that you can just throw money down the well all day long and actually solve problems. Money's not going to do it. A warrior-based reform is going to do that, and that's the only way it's going to happen. You have to work and fight for kids with the types of innovations that all of you have incorporated into your businesses that have magnificently created jobs and opportunity and growth. We have to be education reformers together. The second is work. You know, here's a couple of alarming trends. The General Social Survey shows that between 1996 and 2006, the percentage of Americans saying that their top priority was work that gave them a feeling of accomplishment fell from 60% to 43%. The percentage of Americans who said the most important thing about work was not having a danger of being fired doubled during that period. The culture of work in this country is becoming the culture of work in Europe. And that's a huge problem because that's something that changes this country and is especially true for people at the bottom. Why? Why? The biggest reason, I believe, is because we're telling poor people that they have dead-end jobs. And I did this. I'm guilty of this. You know, I was on an airplane, and if any of you had the bad luck of sitting next to me on an airplane and you had the even worse judgment of striking up a conversation, I would ask you what you do for a living, and then I would grill you for the remainder of the flight about what you do all day long. Because I think it's really, as an economist, I think it's interesting. And I was talking to this guy, and it turns out he's the CFO of a company that owns 750 Burger Kings. Okay, so well, that's interesting. I don't know very much about the fast food industry, and we got to talking about it. And finally, I said, I wasn't thinking clearly, and I said, how do you feel about creating a lot of dead end jobs? I know. And I cringed as soon as I said it because it was not right. But he, you know, his face turned all red and he was thinking about how to answer and I could tell he was angry. And I thought, you know, there's 2 hours left on the flight. And he said, these are not dead end jobs. He said, where do you think I started out? You know, and I think about it and that's a fair point. I started out at the 25th income percentile as a kid. Then as a musician, I made my way all the way to the 10th percentile. I know you're thinking, Arthur, what's your secret? Right? But the guy says, these are not dead-end jobs. If somebody comes to work, if they show up on time, if they don't get high during work, they don't yell at a customer, within 6 months, they're going to be an assistant manager. Within 4 years, they'll be managing a store making six figures. I said, really? He said, yeah, we all started out flipping burgers. He said, there are no dead-end jobs in America. And the greatest disservice that we can perform as leaders and people of privilege is to talk about somebody else's job as a dead-end job. A job is a job, and it's dignified, and it's time for us to be treating everybody with the kind of dignity that people treat us with. Because their job is important, too. Entrepreneurship. You know, one of the problems in the last presidential campaign was when candidates were talking about entrepreneurship, which they always do. They go on and on and on and on. I met a man and he started out living in a tin can in an outhouse in a hole. And, you know, they're talking about how bad their lives are. And then he goes through the whole story and the punchline is always this. And then he made $1 billion. That's always the punchline of these politician stories, right? That's the wrong punchline. The right punchline is, and then he built his life. And then he supported his family. And then he was independent. And then he found dignity. And then he wasn't on the dole. And then people saw that he could earn his success too. That's the American dream. That's what entrepreneurship is all about. That's your life as an enterprise. That's what it should be. But that's not what people said. And the truth is we have an unbelievably virulent crisis of entrepreneurship at the bottom in America today. At this point in the recession, historically, 6 years in, we should be seeing 2/3 more business startups among those who've been laid off in the recession than we're seeing today. A 2/3 decline in business startups among the unemployed in this recession. What is this telling us? People at the bottom, who are most marginalized, are not entrepreneurs. Why? Why? Well, imagine you want to start a business. Easy for us. Because your brother-in-law is a consultant and you know 9 accountants and your neighbor's a lawyer and it's easy. Now, what if you don't speak good English? What if you didn't go to school? What if you don't have systematic access to the internet? What you're going to do is illegal under those circumstances. You just want to cut somebody's yard or put a roof on their house? You can't do it because you have to have a license that costs $1,500. Washington, D.C., if you want a real estate license, which is an upper middle class profession, it takes you 135 hours for licensing. Do you want to be a cosmetologist disproportionately in the bottom 20% of the income distribution? you need 1,500 hours of training to be legal, or you will be shut down. The Washington Post recently was talking to a woman by the name of Isis Brantley, who her most fond desire was to teach hair braiding in her home in Washington, D.C. To do that legally, she was required to have 2,250 hours of training to teach other women to do what she had been doing her entire life. This is a conspiracy against the poor, a conspiracy by the government against the poor. And it's holding them down, and we see the results today. Join me in the idea that if you want to cut a yard, morally, the only thing that you should have to have is a lawnmower. That would be seismic in the way that we treat entrepreneurship. Here's the last point, and probably the most important one of all. Free enterprise isn't an economic alternative. Free enterprise is a moral imperative. Here's how I learned that, and here's why I came into the movement in the first place. When I was a little kid, in 1970, what was poverty around the world? It was a picture in the National Geographic. It was a picture of a kid with flies on his face and a distended belly. And there was nothing I could do except give a couple of pennies on Sunday morning and offer up a lot of prayers. That was all I could do. What's the third world today? To my kids, it's 9% economic growth and our jobs going there. Huh. Well, now that's not quite true because there's a lot of poverty around the world, but the world truly has changed. Here's an example. From 1970 to today, the percentage of the world's population living on a dollar a day or less, this is the standard definition of starvation level poverty from economists, the percentage of the world's population living on a dollar a day or less from 1970 to today has declined by 80%. 80%. Now, most of you didn't know that because it doesn't show up in the papers, and it doesn't show up in the papers because it's unbelievably good news. The world's getting better in this way. So given the fact that this is the first true anti-poverty achievement in the history of the world, we better have an answer as to why. Was it the United Nations or U.S. foreign aid or global socialism or central planning? No, 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 no. It was five things. Five things. According to economists, globalization, free trade, property rights, the rule of law, and entrepreneurship. It was poor people after 1970 with the explosion of mass communications who looked out into the rest of the world, and what did they see? They saw you. They saw your values and your work being rewarded. They saw the American free enterprise system. They said, I want that. I demand that. They threw off the shackles of the rulers in the Soviet Union. They threw off the shackles of poverty in places like Indonesia for the first time in history. And that was because of you. You know, to coin a phrase, you built that. Amazing. How can that happen? That can happen because you are charitable people and you're hardworking people and you have a system that works while you sleep called the free enterprise system. If you believe that the free enterprise system is anything less than a moral imperative, you're not looking out around the world at people who are giving their children food and education for the first time in history and not dying of preventable diseases and not dying of starvation. Those are the moral stakes. That's what you can build. And when we walk away from the free enterprise system, we are inconvenienced. Other people will go to bed hungry. Beware. Beware. The problem that we have is that increasingly the poor in this country and other countries do not have enough exposure to the free enterprise system. They don't. The likelihood of going from the bottom quintile to the middle class or above is down by one-third since 1980. Mobility is falling in this country, and that's a call to action. Our moral obligation is not just to say, hooray for free enterprise and walk away. Our call to action is being as the lucky ones, the ones who are morally obligated to fight for the free enterprise system with no apologies, all demands from our public servants, and looking for a better way through transformation, relief, and opportunity to bring it to more people. This is the greatest system that has ever been created to help all people. It's in our hands. You have 7 seconds. You need to state your purpose, and your purpose and mine needs to be to fight for people through transformation, relief, and opportunity. If we do these things, we will win the future. Not if, when. We'll win the future. But more importantly, we will show everyone that as believers in the system that we're not angry enough to fight for the free enterprise system, but we have enough love in our hearts to fight for the system for all of the men and women around the world. On behalf of my friends at the American Enterprise System, and American Enterprise Institute, my last words are, because you are the ones who make all of this possible, God bless you, and thank you.
Let me start out by suggesting that the definition of compassion, according to some, is an extension of unemployment insurance and an increase in the minimum wage. What's your view on this?
My definition of compassion is not something that destroys the jobs of people at the bottom. And the problem with a lot of well-intentioned policies, like the minimum wage, the problem is that they have something that we call in my business asymmetric impact. If you increase the minimum wage today, which we've done in Washington, D.C., we're going to take it from $7 and change to $11 and change relatively quickly. That's the best way possible to give a wage increase to my teenage children and to destroy jobs of people who are at the bottom with no education. That's the single best way that we can do it. Most of the people who benefit from minimum wage increases are secondary earners in upper income households, and that's fact. Last time we had a minimum wage increase of that size was during the Carter administration, and the result of that is that today you will pump your own gas. Cause and effect. When my dad was a kid, the minimum wage job, what they started off with, was working at a gas station. The reason there aren't any jobs at gas stations was because of those types of policies. We have better ways of dealing with that. It was yesterday with the we were at the Education and Workforce Committee at the U.S. Congress talking about alternatives to that. My view is that politicians should join together in lowering the minimum wage and pairing it with an expansion of the earned income tax credit or a wage subsidy that would lead to a raise for poor people, but that's paid for by all of us because we believe morally we should band together as a society to say that if you work hard and play by the rules, you should be able to support your family, but not to foist that on businesses who will inevitably destroy some of the jobs and that will hurt the people at the margin the most. If you want to help people, do things that actually helps them, as opposed to simply saying you're helping them and walking away.
What do you think will be the impact on GDP of the Affordable Care Act implementation over the next decade?
The Affordable Care Act over the next decade is hard to predict on how it's going to, as Obamacare, for those of you who are keeping score, how it's going to affect GDP is really unknown because we don't know if it's going to be successful. We don't know if it's really going to be implemented. If it were implemented, it will cost money. Guess what? When government does big things and it creates subsidies and transfers for lots of people, it costs money. I mean, that shouldn't be a shock to anybody. Anybody who thinks that somehow we're going to spend more money but it's going to have a negative impact on GDP is sort of living in la-la land. But, you know, or Washington, D.C., to be redundant with you. And you hear all kinds of arguments like that. The real question is whether or not it's going to be a good thing on balance for the economy. You might guess that it is my view that it wouldn't be a good thing. But that said, we have to have alternatives because anybody who thinks that we don't need healthcare reform in this country is not paying very much attention. And the fact is that politicians who could have had free market healthcare reforms in 2005 and 2006 were sitting on their hands. They didn't do anything, which is the reason we have Obamacare today. Ironically, Obamacare, which Republicans hate, is a gift to all Americans from Republicans because they didn't do anything when they had a chance to do something on healthcare reform. So what do we need to do? And the answer is have a solution. Be ready to take control as a very high likelihood in 2016 Republicans will have the House and the Senate and the White House. They better be ready to do something on healthcare reform besides just repealing that thing because that won't be good for the American population. That's what our scholars at AEI are working on. And it's actually what's complicated. It's not impossible. We can and we should and we will have real alternatives.
There are a number of questions having to do with the transformation issue and how do you think transformation can happen? What can be done to encourage it? What besides reducing these regulations can help transform people and encourage entrepreneurship? Can you address that generally?
Personal transformation is interesting. So, you know, I've wrestled with this a lot. I believe, and I know all of you do too, you have strong views on personal redemption. and what people need to do to build their lives, the kind of lives they need to have morally and personally to be successful individuals and happy individuals, full of meaning and giving their families happiness and meaning too. What's the government's role in that? That's the question. What's the government's role in all that? Now, we can set up a Bureau of Greater Happiness, Faith, Family, Community, and Work. I don't recommend that. I think that that would probably have some unintended secondary consequences if the government got in the business of trying to help people go to church more, for example. It'll also have some constitutional implications, is my guess. But if I were president of the United States, let me tell you what I'd do every day before my feet hit the floor. I would say to myself, what can I do today such that the government stops getting in the way of those things? What can I take apart? What presidential order can I roll back? What regulation can I destroy? What law can I suggest that rolls back the overweening nanny state that's getting in the way of people exercising their free religious rights? That's making it hard. They like that. Apparently the only religious people in the room here. I don't know about the rest of you. What can I do today that makes family life easier, not harder? Look, the tax code is full of all kinds of barriers to people having well-organized traditional families. All kinds of barriers to that. What can I do to get out of the way of people actually doing what makes them the happiest and most fulfilled? That's not a big government program. That's a little government effort. What can I do today to have communities of integrity that are not fragmented? And what can I do today that encourages work, doesn't discourage it? Because if I destroy something today that's in the way of faith, family, community, and work, I've done something good for poor people. And that's where I'd start.
You mentioned what the president needs to be thinking about every day. Someone has asked us via Twitter, what do you think is the most important question that 2016 presidential candidates will need to answer?
The most important question that they never answer and they need to be able to answer is, why do you want to be president? You know, it's astonishing. I have this wonderful job where I get to know all of them. And I talk to them, and you ask that question, they're not very good at answering it. And maybe it's because they don't want to tell the truth, which is, I've always wanted to be president. That's a terrible answer. Actually, that's disqualifying. But being able to say morally, what is your purpose? Being able to say that, I think it's the most important thing that we'll be able to address. Americans are very cynical about politicians. You've seen the data, and so have I. They're very cynical of people who want to be president. It's hard for them to get their minds around trusting people who want to be in that particular position. And unless people are morally suited to be able to say what their purpose is in a straightforward and a clear, honest way, Americans are not going to be able to make a good decision. I think that that's really critical. There are a bunch of policy issues that are going to manifest as well. I talked about education a little bit. You know, we tend to not talk about it when we don't have to because it's not a top 10 issue. But unless we have presidential candidates who talk about that particular issue very clearly in 2016, we're going to be on the path of former great power status. That is the most important thing that we can get our minds around. It's so critical. And then talking about, one of the things that actually has fallen into disrepair is the way that we talk about national security. What does it actually mean for American leadership to be an act of global brotherhood? What does that mean to you? If I could get the answers to those particular questions, I would actually have insight into character. And then I would know where to burrow in on the policy questions of the day.
Thanks so much, Dr. Brooks, for taking the time to speak with us today. Please join us next month on Tuesday, February 4th, to hear from our guest, Henry Hank Paulson, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury and founder of the Paulson Institute. Please don't miss out on the opportunity to hear from this very accomplished man who served his country at a critical time in our nation's history and who continues to have a significant impact on our world today. Information and tickets for Secretary Paulson's address and for each of this season's presentations can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Have a safe afternoon, and we look forward to seeing you next month.
.1 WFYI's Sam Clement follows up with Arthur C. Brooks in this interview.
You talked a lot about the opportunity for people that may have, be coming from the lower ranks, per se. Can you talk about maybe your own journey of how did you kind of build your way up to the top? What was that process like, and how much did that play into your current philosophy?
I had a lot of good luck. I had parents who really, I mean, we didn't have money, but my parents cared a lot about education. They cared a lot about the values that people typically see that helps them in their own journey. And I feel fortunate for that, but I can't look out and say that everybody has the good luck of having the parents that I had. And that's why we need a system that helps, that gives people a leg up more effectively, that talks about the personal transformation and the relief, but most importantly, that provides the economic and the social opportunities that everybody should enjoy in the American system.
How do you keep those children on that path? I mean, obviously, it's easy to say, okay, let's create a path for them, but there's so many outside influences. How do you keep them along that path, and what needs to be put in place to kind of give them that guidance?
Well, the first thing is getting rid of policies and politics and questioning leaders who put obstacles in their path. I mean, people who stand for the education status quo that hurts so many and marginalizes so many kids, systems that largely benefit grown-ups, not kids, these things have to go. I mean, they don't hurt people in the top 10% anything like what they do to people in the bottom 25%. So just the barriers we put in kids' way, that's the first thing that we should look at, is what do we do such that people have better, more integrity-filled communities, people have it find it easier to start families, that people get educational opportunities and entrepreneurship opportunities, notwithstanding the fact that they started poor or didn't get a good education. What can we do?
How do you break through that mold of maybe giving a job to someone that you know or someone that looks like you and someone that maybe is outside of your comfort zone? How do you extend and create a culture of extending to those that maybe wouldn't have been given that look otherwise?
Well, that's one of the ways that we have a culture of inclusiveness in this country that has separate the United States traditionally from other countries around the world. The truth is, we have been able to absorb immigrants in a way that no other country ever has. We're more racially tolerant and diverse than most other countries around the world, and that those are the values. Those are not just coincidences. This happens because we're a country that has the culture and principles of free enterprise, of competition, of upward mobility, of dreaming of something better. And that's what we need to renew, remembering that, incidentally, it's not just a question of small businesses only hiring people who look like them. The real problem is that government and big business and big labor are in bed together and conspiring against the rest of us is really what's going on in this country. You know, we have cronyism that's absolutely rampant. We have welfare for large corporations. That's what's really making people struggle. That's what's strangling the ability of people to get ahead who don't have the right connections, and that's got to go.
Dr. Brooks, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
You've been listening to Arthur C. Brooks, president of American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, part of the 2013-2014 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Next month at this time, join us for a speech from Henry Paulson, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury and founder of the Paulson Institute. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Alsett.
Support is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025, focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. And by the team at Gelser Investment Management, focused on individuals and families, helping to build, manage, preserve, and transfer wealth for generations. Commemorating 45 years in business. Gelser.